Hello, and welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Lee Moore. Today, Margot Patterson talks with John T. Lash. John was sentenced to life in prison at the age of 18. He will share his insights into why a restorative justice model is better than our punishment model for victims and offenders alike. Then later, the ACLU Minute and the calendar of events. Now, Margot Patterson and John T. Lash.
Hello, this is Margot Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio. Our subject today is the treatment of juveniles in our nation's prisons, and specifically the sentence of life without parole given for some crimes committed by juvenile offenders. In June of this year, the Supreme Court ruled that mandatory sentences of life without parole for juvenile offenders could no longer be imposed, that some consideration had to be given to an offender's age, family background, history of mental illness, etc., in sentencing. Just to be clear, this does not mean that courts cannot sentence juvenile offenders to life without parole. It just means that they cannot do so automatically. We're talking today to John T. Lash. John is a regular contributor to the Juvenile Justice Information Exchange. That's an initiative of the Center for Sustainable Journalism at Kennesaw State University in Georgia. John is also a program director of the Georgia Conflict Center, and he is himself a former offender. John, tell us a little about your background.
Sure, Margot. I'm 46 years old, and I went to prison in 1985 when I was 18 for the crime of murder, and I received a life sentence. And that was, for me, I was a pretty tough place in my life then, and the first few years I was in prison were pretty hard. I was at a prison for young offenders, not technically a juvenile facility, but for kids who had been transferred to the adult side of the system for whatever reason. It's probably the worst prison I did time in almost 25 years. Got out in 2009 and started school in 2011, almost finished. I'm also working at a place called the Georgia Conflict Center here, and I live in Athens, Georgia.
And what does the Georgia Conflict Center do?
The Conflict Center is, we have a couple of projects that we're involved in. We go to a local high school that's, it's not an alternative school, but it's a school, though, for kids who have had issues around attendance or performance. We meet with a group of kids there once a week, and we talk about communication skills with geared towards conflict resolution. How can they better solve the conflicts in their lives? What kind of skills can help them get where they want to go? And so that's one project that we're doing. Another project that we do is train what we call peacemakers. They're volunteers from neighborhoods here in Athens that have been identified as low-income, high rates of crime, and things along those lines, those social indicators. So these identified neighborhoods are able to receive training, although we train them some of the same communication skills that we do with the kids, with the addition of work, training them to work as facilitators, peacemakers, to be that third party in their own communities, to be the third party that other people can go to when they have problems, with the aim of reducing police involvement or elevated conflict, even violence. Third project that we're developing now that hasn't gotten off the ground yet is a restorative justice conferencing program with the local juvenile court here and with the Department of Juvenile Justice, where we would take kids who have been referred to us, walk with them through a conferencing process, which is basically a large meeting that brings together the offending child, the victim or victims of their crime, affected community members, family members, people like that, and look for some way that the kid can move forward to adjust their behavior, not to punish. The goal would be not to punish them, but to restore them to the community. So that's the three big ones that we have. And then we do other kinds of training that we get contracted for. Could be sales forces, or we did a training with a women's shelter here around conflict resolution, things like that. So,
well, I want to ask you a little later more about the restorative justice program, but maybe right now I'm most curious, how do you think your life experience affected your perceptions of how offenders, both adult and juvenile, should be treated in prisons?
Yeah, that's a great question. My journey through my time in prison was one of evolution, and over time, as I began to change myself and to look at what I was experiencing and to look around me at the majority of people that I was with, there's a real disconnection between whatever it is that you do that lands you in prison and the consequences of that action. So, for instance, there isn't a real correlation in my mind between if you broke into somebody's house or you murder someone or you got caught shoplifting. You're basically, if you go to prison, you're experiencing exactly the same thing, exactly the same level of whatever, and it's typically not good. I really have begun to question the value for a long time. I've questioned the value of punitive approaches to criminal justice. I don't think that they work. And so while I was in and I began to study communication, conflict resolution, and restorative justice, restorative justice gave me the framework to see that while we may want to separate people from the rest of society for safety reasons, there's no reason that that separation itself has to be a kind of punishment. And in fact, that punishment is going to increase the chances that this person is going to become even more disconnected from society, even less likely to go along with what society would like to see from them. So I think it's a process that's actually working against its stated goal.
Could you say a little bit more about the goals of restorative justice programs and also how they work? Because I'm not sure I understand completely how a restorative justice program might work for different types of offenders.
Yeah, so if you look at the philosophical or the underpinnings of restorative justice, for instance, right now, with the current criminal justice model, if someone commits a crime, legally and procedurally, the crime has been committed against the state, the government. The government prosecutes the crime or doesn't. It's totally up to them. The victim is often left out of the process altogether. If they are, it's a minimal involvement in most places. The offender is placed into an adversarial position. You know, the criminal justice system is adversarial by design, which has its virtues, but yet when someone is in an adversarial position, they're not really able to, for instance, step up and take responsibility or admit that they've done something wrong because there are consequences to kind of owning up to what's happened. So a restorative approach would place the victim of the crime at the center of the process. That crime, in fact, is not a violation of rules, but is a kind of harm that has been done to someone, and that someone is the victim. So by bringing the victim together with the offender, and also their people that are connected to them, their families, their co-workers, community members, other people have been impacted by the actions of the offender. You bring all those people together with the goal of taking care of the needs of everyone that's been involved, taking care of the needs first of the victim, what needs to happen for them, taking care of the needs of the offender, what needs to happen so that they might be restored to society, that they might be put in a position to get whatever it is that they need, and then taking care of all those other people as well. Does that help you understand kind of the underpinnings of it?
That is helpful.
So, for instance, here in Athens, the program we're looking at is a conferencing model. So we would bring these various parties, these stakeholders, together in a meeting where what they're saying isn't going to, what the offender's saying isn't going to be held against them. It's not going to be used for judgment. In fact, in a lot of restorative systems for juveniles, the kid is basically already admitted to whatever the crime is. Then it's looking for ways that can repair those harms, preferably without separating that child from society, without putting them in some kind of lockup. sometimes that's going to happen, of course. But restorative approaches can even be used in serious cases in homicides. Restorative approaches have been used internationally in cases of, situations of genocide and, warfare and human rights violations, a lot of different settings. So even if the person needs to be separated for some reason, there's still the potential there to gain mutual understanding between all the parties involved. Mutual understanding for the offender to take responsibility for their actions. My own experience is that being incarcerated typically moves people away from taking responsibility for their own actions, because there's a disconnect between what happens to people when they're in prison and why they're there. You really, and the longer you're in, the further you get away from that. Often people in prison are being victimized all the time in different ways, and they don't really make the connection, because there really isn't a good connection between whatever it is that they did to get there and what's happening to them now. And when someone is experiencing that, they're usually not in the position to say, hey, to reflect on their life, to take responsibility for whatever decisions they've made.
Sure. John, I'm just going to jump in here now. For those listeners who have just tuned in, we are talking to John T. Lash. John is a writer with the Juvenile Justice Information Exchange, and he is himself a former prisoner. And we're talking about restorative justice. We're talking about the treatment of juvenile offenders. John, I'm curious, do restorative justice programs, are those have special relevance for juvenile offenders? Are they used more often for juvenile offenders?
Yes. In the United States in particular, restorative justice programs are much more prevalent in juvenile settings. I think that's not because they don't work with adults, but it's because it's an easier sell. I don't know what the percentages are, but probably most restorative justice programs in the U.S. are for kids, and then a few add on adults. People in general are more ready to accept the idea that a kid is prepared and able to change, to be different, especially if they're supported in that change. So the converse of that, I guess, is that when people see adults, they're less likely to extend that kind of mercy towards them. They're less likely to want to give them that chance. They're more likely to kind of take a condemning standpoint. So that's the only reason I think that split exists.
I want to ask you two things. One is a personal question. What helped you mm-hmm. turn your life around in prison? Because I think you mm-hmm. mentioned that your life did start changing around in prison. And then, yeah. Two, I want to get to the effect of this Supreme Court ruling in June of this year. But perhaps the first question about your own life and how you were able to change it.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I get that a lot from people. Even when I was in prison, people would often find it difficult to believe that as a teenager that I had killed someone, and I just didn't fit the stereotype, even inside the prison itself. A couple of things came together for me. I began to go to school to get more educated. At that time, college classes were available in the prison. Another thing was that I began to practice meditation. A friend of mine gave me a book one day, and I had a lot of anxiety. It's a very stressful setting, and I thought, hey, here's something that might help me out. And I began in the probably about 1987 or 88 to just practice meditation every day. And I did that for more than 20 years. And that in itself, I'm trying to think how to put it. So put those things together with, for instance, the recent research about the development of the brain. Now it looks like, from what I read, that our brains are not really fully developed until they're 25 or so, especially for males. I think right as I was beginning that shift towards adulthood, I began the practice of meditation, also shown to alter the way that you think, literally to alter the structure of your brain. So I put those things together, and I think there was an instant in my time when I'd probably been in a few years, and one day it was just like somebody flipped a switch in my mind. I looked around, and there was just such a chaotic scene. There were all these people running up and down the aisle, screaming and hollering and waving sticks, and it was just madness. And I just looked out and I just asked myself, I said, why am I here? I knew that I wasn't an unintelligent person. My friends in school had gone on to, you know, be very successful in their lives. And that question right there, like, why am I here? What have I knew somewhere that I had made a mistake in my own thinking. And I just began to look at that and I began to question myself, my assumptions about everything. And I still do that. So I'm on that path today. And that's led to the changes that happened in my life, the development of compassion for other people, development of empathy, all of those things that make me who I am now.
Well, it seems to me your own life is a strong argument for why people should not be put in prison for life without any possibility of parole. But I want to talk just a little bit about the ruling in June of this year, where the Supreme Court ruled in Miller versus Alabama that states could not automatically send juveniles to prison for life without any chances of parole. What do you think the impact of that ruling is going to be?
I think it's going to be a long road to hoe for everybody that's involved. Far down the road, we'll see these sentences eliminated altogether, my own guess. The problem now is all these people that are stuck in between. So the ruling prohibited what they call mandatory sentencing schemes, where a lot of states have adopted, there's no discretion on the part of the judge or the jury other than maybe death or life without parole, and these sentences are mandated. So you have these kids, for instance, in Florida, where there is no other sentence for murder besides life without parole or the death sentence. Since juveniles have been removed from eligibility for a death sentence, they're stuck right now. The question is going to be, and what's going to be fought out, I think, in every state where this matters, is whether or not the ruling is retroactive. You've already seen a few judges in Florida saying the ruling is not retroactive. Some states have just already changed their laws. As soon as this ruling came out, they put it in front of the legislature, and now those sentences don't even exist anymore. In one state, I'm not remembering, it was in the Midwest, where I think the governor just changed all of the sentences to, I forget, it was a number of years. So you're seeing a multitude of responses. I think we're going to have a lot of confusion, and I think some of these cases are going to start making their way back up. They're going to start getting back into the federal court again. God knows how long this is going to take. I'm not an attorney either, so this is my opinion based on my own research and my own writing about this subject. There's a lot more that could be said about it.
Well, I understand the confusion is whether this ruling is going to apply retroactively. Is that something that will be kind of handled at the lower courts level, do you think, or is that going to go up to the Supreme Court again and they'll have to rule on that?
One of my colleagues, who is an attorney, she also writes for the Juvenile Justice Information Exchange, said that the real question is whether or not the ruling is what they call substantive. So, you know, the ruling was 5-4. For some people, this argues that it was just about those particular cases. For instance, there was a comment on my story from the it's called the National Organization of Victims of Juvenile Lifers, and they're opposed to resentencing of these kids. In fact, they've been fighting against the ending of juvenile life without parole for I'm not sure how many years, but quite a few years. So, is the ruling substantive or not? Is what's going to be addressed locally first, you know, on a state level, then I think whichever way it goes, you're going to see the cases appealed. It's going to start going into the federal system. So will it make it all the way back to the Supreme Court? Will they look at it again? You know, it's so hard to say what they're going to do. People were unsure if they were even going to take these cases on this year. I know a few people at the Center for Fair Sentencing to Youth, and when the ruling came out, I called the guy and talked to him. I said, "Oh, this is terrific. You know, what are you guys going to do now? You know, you're going to have to get a new job." And he said, "Well, no, we're not." He said, "There's a lot here that people aren't really understanding yet, and that some states are going to continue to fight against this. Some prosecutors are going to fight against it. The kid is a kid in Florida right now, Christian Fernandez, and this question, he is, you know, preparing to go to trial right now, or maybe he's in trial now. I think he's 13, killed his little brother maybe a year or so ago. So he was very young murderer. Even now, his defense is arguing that there's no law in place to sentence him, but yet the prosecutors are saying that's not true. So it's even being heard in an actual ongoing case. So you have the people that are in prison under these sentences, some of whom are quite old now. There's one gentleman in Louisiana who was sentenced as a juvenile to life without parole. He's been in prison 50 plus years. I can't remember his name right now. He's the oldest or the longest serving prisoner, I think, in the country now.
John, I'm going to have to bring this to a close, unfortunately. Thank you so much for talking to us. KKFI, Jaws of Justice. We've been talking to John Lash about life in prison without parole for juvenile offenders and about his own experiences in prison. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for the chance to talk with you.
Today, we are rolling out a new zero-tolerance policy for schools.
I'm singer-songwriter Patty Larkin, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
The motivation? The case of 8-year-old David Morales from Coventry, Rhode Island, who glued tiny plastic Army action figures onto a camouflage baseball cap and wore it to school. And the problem is? The problem is that David's school has what it calls a zero-tolerance policy for weapons. And the tiny toy soldier glued onto the second grader's hat violated that policy. People complained, of course. And Superintendent Ken DiPietro eventually admitted that, quote, "the events exposed how a policy meant to ensure a safe environment can prevent an image counter to the work of our schools to promote patriotism and democracy," and, he went on, "support the military." Wow. The superintendent apparently still doesn't get it. Would an Army action figure in an art class with an international peace sign drawn over it still be illegal in his schools? So, here's the new proposed zero-tolerance policy. The policy will say that the school will have zero tolerance for any zero-tolerance policy applied in a manner that is stupid, counterproductive, teaches bad lessons, hurts students, and does violence to the Constitution.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU at ACLU.org. So let me sing my song. Support the ACLU because freedom can't defend itself.
This is Keith Brownio, and this is the Jaws of Justice radio calendar for November 26, 2012. The Kansas City VA Medical Center is one of the 50 VA MCs selected across the nation to serve as an enrollment site for the Millions of Veterans Programs research program that will help us better understand how genes affect veterans' health and illness. The Million Veterans Program is a national voluntary research program conducted by the Department of Veteran Affairs, Office of Research and Development. The ultimate goal of the program is to transform healthcare. If you are a veteran, you can find out more or volunteer to participate by visiting the website of the Million Veteran Program at www.research.va.gov/MVP or call toll-free 866-441-6075. The National Association of the Criminal Defense Lawyers is pleased to offer a resource for its members and, as a service to the public, a collection of individual downloadable documents that profile the law and the practice in each U.S. jurisdiction relating to relief from collateral consequences of convictions. The 54 jurisdictional profiles include provisions of loss and restoration of civil rights and firearm privileges, legal mechanisms for overcoming and mitigating collateral consequences, and provisions addressing non-discriminatory and discrimination in employment and licensing. This information can be found at www.nacdl.org/ Rights Restoration / You can find the calendar, these calendar items and much more at www.facebook.com/ Jaws of Justice Radio.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we left you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, or its staff or volunteers. If you have comments or questions, check out the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. You can also join Jaws of Justice Radio Group by emailing us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. My name is Lee Moore, and we thank our engineer, Mike Murphy. Listen in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for Law and Disorder, Iyad Burnett, head of the Popular Committee of Belen, Palestine, and Jim Douglas, author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why Did He Die and Why It Matters. Then at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer. Up next is Counterspin, followed at 10 o'clock by Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m.